This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, July 16th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Karnatz. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics sits down with representatives from each side of the Cotton prior Senate race. Also, a new report analyzes the potential economic impact of alcohol sales on three dry counties in Arkansas.
Plus, we explore War Eagle Cavern, spend some time with the Beaver Lake Sailing Club, and more. But first, officials with the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank expect to serve between 750 and 800,000 meals this year to food insecure residents of the area. And a grant announced yesterday will help provide several of those meals. The Alcoa Foundation contributed $15,000 to the organization, which will help provide roughly 3,000 meals. Carrie Harlow, the Director of Development for the Food Bank, says food security is a pressing issue for some in Northwest Arkansas.
I think with the economy and the jobs, people are really having a hard time finding a job, or they're either underemployed where, you know, with some of the companies having to downsize, they're not getting paid as much, but they still have mortgages and car payments and insurance and all that, so they're not able to put the food on the table. So we're seeing quite a bit of that.
While one in six families are classified as food insecure nationally, in Northwest Arkansas, one in four families deal with hunger-related issues. Harlow says corporate and foundation support helps the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank assist those families.
You know, we get grants through several different foundations. Alcoa has been a very great, great partner. We have a grant from them. But we also get quite a bit of individual donors and, you know, food drives. And we have piggy bank competitions and stuff like that.
Harlow says if individuals or organizations want to host a food drive or provide other support, they can visit nwafoodbank.org or call 872-8774.
Last night, the Fort Smith City Board of Directors agreed to assist the Ark Best Corporation with its previously announced expansion project at Chaffee Crossing. The board affirmed its intent to issue up to $46 million in industrial revenue bonds to Ark Best for construction and equipment cost related to its new headquarters building. As part of the agreement, approved by city directors, the city would issue $30 million in bonds toward construction of the headquarters, and roughly $16 million in bonds to be used for office furnishings and computer equipment. In lieu of property tax payments, Ark Best would pay half of what it would normally pay in ad valorem taxes back to the city over the course of several years as repayment for the bonds, and the city would then distribute those payments to the parties who would normally get the property tax proceeds, like the Fort Smith School District. But a recent economic analysis model suggests the area economy may be getting a favorable deal in exchange for that public funding. Gregory Hamilton is a senior economic researcher at UALR, and he says the 975 jobs promised by Ark Best could have a substantial economic impact by 2021.
Well, there's 975 jobs, and if we look at the measure of gross state product, our gross domestic product at the state level, the 975 jobs will lead to about $73 million of additional gross regional product in Fort Smith. That's the direct. The total comes out to be about $248 million, almost $249 million in Fort Smith.
Hamilton says that's the total sales input if those 975 initial jobs promised by Ark Best indirectly create about 888 jobs elsewhere in the regional economy. And those total 1,863 jobs would create nearly $104 million in labor income in the area economy. But those numbers do come with a caveat.
This is 975 jobs. Okay, where did the people come from to fill these jobs? Did they come from out of state and they're brand new people into the state? But they could also be from local people. And in that case, they would be displacing work. Those people already employed, they quit their job and go to another, to this job. So that's, this could be local displacement of activity, of jobs. It could be local displacement of businesses, too, because of this, which would make it much smaller.
Hamilton also notes a lot can happen between now and 2021, like new technology displacing people from the labor force.
The baseball and track training center under construction at the University of Arkansas got substantially closer to reality yesterday with a multi-million dollar gift. The Wallace and Jara Fowler family contributed $2.5 million to the project, which UA athletics officials say marks substantial progress toward meeting the project's fundraising goal. The 52,000 square foot facility will be a climate controlled practice space with a full sized practice infield, throwing and batting areas, and ancillary team spaces. Track and field athletes will gain an expansive warm up area for track meets and space for indoor throwing events to be held on site. With the contribution, the training center will likely be named the Fowler Family Baseball and Track Training Center.
A junior on the Razorback soccer team is getting a jump on the 2014 season. Ashley Ellenwood has been invited to participate in U.S. Under-23 Women's National Team Training Camp in Seattle this month. She's one of just 24 players to receive such an invitation. She was an All-SEC selection last year as Arkansas's team advanced to the NCAA tournament for the first time in program history. The Razorbacks will host Creighton in an exhibition game August 14th and officially open the season at home against Utah State on August 22nd.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals are in second place in the Texas League North after losing to Tulsa 8-4 last night, while the Arkansas Travelers swept a doubleheader from Springfield in North Little Rock. The Naturals, who trail the Travs by a full game in their current four-game homestand tonight against Tulsa at Arvis Ballpark. First pitch is scheduled for 7:05.
Forecast this evening calls for mostly cloudy skies with a 30% chance of showers after 8 o'clock. Overnight lows from 58 in northwest Arkansas to 63 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Thursday, cloudy with a 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high of 69 in northwest Arkansas. An 80% chance of showers and a high of 72 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow evening, cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely. Overnight lows from 61 to 64.
This is Ozarks at Large. It's a heavyweight battle, the marquee matchup, the Arkansas Brawl, and it is the cover story of the latest magazine edition of Talk Business and Politics, U.S. Senator Mark Pryor versus U.S. Congressman Tom Cotton in the biggest race in Arkansas in 2014, and one of the most closely watched Senate races in the nation, as it may be pivotal to control of the U.S. Senate. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics recently discussed the race with David Ray, Communications Director for Tom Cotton for Senate, and Eric Dory, Deputy Campaign Manager for Mark Pryor for Senate.
Well, before we get into campaign mechanics here, let's just talk about kind of the high-profile nature of this this election, this campaign. You guys have like a national spotlight on you, not just the state spotlight on you. Do you guys feel the pressure in terms of all of those eyeballs and all of that national media attention that's going on?
Well, it's a big race, not just for Arkansas. It's a big race for America. Most people around the country feel that Washington's headed in the wrong direction. And so the 2014 midterms are a chance to change course and send some new folks to Washington who will begin to roll back the damage that's been done over the last 5.5 years of the Obama administration.
What about you? Are you feeling the pressure?
Well, sure, there's pressure. I mean, you just heard David Ray talk a lot about Washington and about the national spotlight. But for Mark Pryor, this race is all about Arkansas and what's best for the state and putting Arkansas first. And the issues that matter to Arkansans and the issues that matter to folks that are trying to make ends meet here in Arkansas are what we're focused on. And the contrast between Mark Pryor and Tom Cotton just couldn't be more clear.
Well, we'll get to some of those contrasts. Let's start with some of the news of the week in terms of some things that had you guys volleying exchanges with one another. And for people that don't follow you guys on Twitter, they need to, because it is entertainment in and of itself, as well as very interesting political theatrics. Faith played a big argument in the debate this week. We've got a quote here that shows something that Tom Cotton said about a little over a week ago when he was talking about the Hobby Lobby decision, David. He talked about, it's another example of how Obamacare infringes on the liberties of all Arkansans. Barack Obama, Mark Pryor, think that faith is something that only happens at 11 a.m. on Sunday mornings. That's when we worship, but faith is what we live every single day. Tell me what Congressman Cotton was trying to say in that comment.
Well, I think what we've seen is Senator Pryor take a lot of offense to what was said in a TV interview, but what he hasn't taken offense to is the fact that in this Hobby Lobby decision, it's been affirmed that Obamacare forces Christians to violate their deeply held religious beliefs. That's not me saying that. That's the Supreme Court of the United States saying that. What we haven't seen him take a lot of offense to is the fact that Obamacare forces Christian taxpayers to fund abortions, the fact that in America today, an unborn child can be aborted even after they can feel pain at 20 weeks. Senator Pryor doesn't seem to be offended by any of that.
I would suspect Senator Pryor has a different position. I see you shaking your head there.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I mean, it's really unfortunate that Congressman Cotton chose last week to make such a deeply personal attack on Mark Pryor's Christian faith. If there's one thing Arkansans know about Mark Pryor, it's that he's a devout Christian, someone whose faith guides him to put Arkansas first and be a steady and reliable voice for Arkansans. And for Congressman Cotton to stoop so low as to question the sincerity of his faith is something that is, it's just beyond the pale.
Was he questioning the sincerity of his faith?
No, Tom Cotton's been very clear from the beginning of this campaign that it's extremely admirable that Senator Pryor is a fellow Christian and that he practices his faith with commendable openness. But that's what this Hobby Lobby decision was about. It's about the role of religion and faith in the public sphere. And what Obamacare forces Christians to do is it says, you know, you can believe whatever you want on Sunday morning in your church, but don't you dare take that into the workplace the other 6 days of the week, because we're going to explain to you as a federal government which precepts of your faith you can follow and which ones we disagree with.
David, do you think that leap, though, is made in terms of logic between a voter hearing that statement and then tying it to Obamacare in that way?
I mean, set Obamacare aside for one second. Congressman Cotton called Mark Pryor a once-a-week Christian. He said that Mark Pryor believes that faith is something that happens only at 11 o'clock on Sunday mornings, and that's offensive. And the fact that Congressman Cotton has not only refused to apologize, but doubled down on those comments and then just outright lied about Mark Pryor's record when it comes to the very serious issue of abortion. Congressman Cotton has said that Mark Pryor supports late-term abortions and federal funding for abortions. In fact, he supports neither. He has voted consistently in the Senate to ban late-term abortions and stop all federal funding for abortions, and it's something he feels strongly about.
Would love to keep talking about this subject. We've got other things to get to, so let's shift to disaster relief, another big area of combat between your two campaigns this past week. This was kind of a political storm, no pun intended there. Mark Pryor has made an issue of 5 Congressman Cotton votes related to FEMA funding, disaster relief funding. Cotton campaign pointed out this week that there have been 3 times that Congressman Cotton has supported FEMA and disaster relief funding. Eric, I'll ask you the question first. Is this a matter of the Pryor campaign being selective about which votes it wants to portray as accurate and inaccurate for Congressman Cotton?
Absolutely not. I mean, the fact is that Congressman Cotton has voted consistently against disaster relief that has helped Arkansas families recover from devastating
storms.
There
were 3 votes where he did cast votes.
I mean,
let's
take those 3 votes, one of which was about what never became law. The other was a stopgap measure in the government shutdown that Congressman Cotton caused. He was one of that small minority of reckless and irresponsible House members that cheerled the government shutdown. From his second week in office, Congressman Cotton went on a radio show and said, I got the question, you know, if the Democrats are digging their heels and Republicans aren't getting what they want, are you prepared to shut down the government? And Congressman Cotton said, yes, I am.
Give me Congressman Cotton's perspective on this.
Look, Tom Cotton supports full funding of FEMA. He supported it in the fiscal year 14, Department of Homeland Security appropriation. Eric wants to talk about bills not passing. Not much passes in Washington these days because Harry Reid and Mark Pryor won't allow anything to come for a vote in the Senate. You know, Senator Pryor and his allies for weeks have been politicizing these tornadoes that ripped through Mayflower and Valonia. And if we needed any further evidence of that this week, there's the fact that their campaign lied to and took advantage of a storm victim in Mayflower and for the purposes of filming an attack ad on his property. Their campaign called this man, Mr. Boydston, and told him they were going to assist with cleanup efforts to remove debris. As a matter of fact, when they showed up, they did no such cleanup. In fact, they just filmed attack ads against Tom Cotton on his property. They lied to him. They misled him. That's not the Arkansas way.
Lies and misleading. Strong comments.
Yeah, there you go again, David. It's absolutely false to say that Congressman Cotton supports disaster relief. He has voted every single chance he got. There's not a single dollar that is being spent today to help Mayflower or Valonia victims of this disaster recover that Congressman Cotton voted for appropriations. And when it comes to everything else David said, this is an important thing to point out, because what Congressman Cotton's campaign has done this week is try to politicize and silence the voice of the mayor of Mayflower. The mayor of Mayflower is an independent. He's not a Republican. He's not a Democrat. And he has great things to say about Tim Griffin, about John Bozeman, about Asa Hutchinson, Mike Ross, and Mark Pryor, who was there from day one with his sleeves rolled up, no cameras present, helping to pack boxes and help these volunteers and bring every dollar that could be brought to these families to help them recover. But Congressman Cotton was nowhere to be found.
Well, it wasn't in his congressional district. Why would he? Wouldn't he be politicizing
The important thing to remember is that not only has Tom Cotton supported full funding of FEMA, he also supported all five disaster relief declarations for the tornado victims in Mayflower and Valonia. He supported numerous disaster declarations for Arkansas, whether it's ice storms, whether it's flooding. They're simply trying to distract from the fact, using the Hurricane Sandy bill and overlaying that with footage of Mayflower and Valonia, which is insulting to the intelligence of voters. It's also insulting to the storm victims who are recovering. And you know what? These are important, weighty issues. And I know that it's good for Eric and I to get together to discuss them. But, you know, we really should have Mark Pryor and Tom Cotton here debating those issues and many more issues. But Senator Pryor refuses to back off his no debate position. And we've agreed to three televised debates.
No, I got to jump in there for a second. What David is completely ignoring is the fact that Congressman Cotton is desperate right now. And you've seen a series of news articles this week talking about how underwhelming and unimpressive Congressman Cotton is as a candidate. And that's because what folks at the national scene are figuring out is what folks in Arkansas have already figured out, is that Congressman Cotton just is not connecting.
It's not that hard to get a story, though, planted in the national media, is it?
Well, it's not hard.
Yes, we're so desperate that we've been ahead in the last seven polls conducted, and Senator Pryor still refuses to debate.
Pryor's got polls, too.
This is going to be a close race, but I want to go back for one second to something David said just a minute ago, which is that that Congressman Cotton supports disaster relief. He does not and has not, and he has consistently made up excuses. And here's the best point to illustrate this, is that when we put up on our website a video of the mayor of Mayflower, the justice of the peace of Faulkner County, and other pillars of the community talking about Congressman Cotton's conspicuous absence in the wake of the storms and his votes against disaster relief, when do you think Tom Cotton showed up for the first time in Mayflower? It was just a few days later.
I don't think you need any more evidence to prove that their campaign has been politicizing this tragedy than to look at what happened this week with Doug Boydston. The footage that he's referring to was ill-gotten footage that they recorded by lying to a man who has lost his livelihood in the storm, who has seen his property looted in the days following the storm, and they misled him. He has come out and said this publicly. He has been on radio, in print. He has said this over and over.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business and Politics, speaking with David Ray, Communications Director for Tom Cotton for Senate, and Eric Dory, Deputy Campaign Manager for Mark Pryor for Senate. More information is available at talkbusiness.net. Support for Talk Business and Politics on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com.
Diana Nyad has never forgotten something her father told her many, many years ago.
The day I turned 5, he said, look in the dictionary, definition, Nyad, woman, champion, swimmer. I became a swimmer, but that's not the word I heard. I heard the word champion.
The making of a champion, next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday at noon on KUAF.
A new study looks at the economic impact of alcohol sales on 3 of Arkansas's dry counties. But how do you research something that hasn't happened yet?
One of the assumptions we made is that the people in these counties are pretty much like the people, average Arkansans everywhere. And we know that on average, Arkansans spend $191 a year on liquor and wine sales. They spend another $150 a year on beer sales. And so if we assume that the folks in these counties are in fact acting like demographically similar people throughout Arkansas, we can assume that they're actually already spending money on retail liquor, and this just gives them an opportunity to spend that money closer to home.
Kathy Deck, director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Arkansas, will discuss the report coming up in about 10 and a half minutes on Ozarks at Large.
The Beaver Lake Sailing Club hosted its 3rd annual dock walk on Saturday evening. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich saw it as a good excuse to go to the lake and has this report.
Temperatures were creeping up into the mid-90s by late Saturday afternoon, but on the shores of Mulder Hollow near Lost Bridge District on Beaver Lake, it was breezy and cool at the Beaver Lake Sailing Club. Sailing Club member Judy Walker takes us to Dock 1, where Casita, her 24-foot Hunter sailboat, is tethered.
We have about 100 boats, maybe closer to 90, actually.
The club site is very pretty, nestled in a forested cove filled with crystal clear green Beaver Lake water. According to club history written by its first commodore, James Dunn, the club formed in 1965, just after the lake impoundment had filled. Dues were $10, and sailors initially met on the steep banks of the copper mine side of LaRue Peninsula. A few cars in that era would be submerged, boat trailering mishaps at that rough spot. A year later, the club's first regatta was held at Prairie Creek. Members routinely traveled to other lakes to race their Lasers, Demons, Catalinas, and other craft in U.S.-tiered events. Rocky Branch Marina served as the club's first home, but in 1978, members purchased this place, a 20-acre parcel near Lost Bridge, well-protected from winds, situated in deep water. The purchase price, $13,500. The Beaver Lake Sailing Club incorporated as a nonprofit in 1979, with charter members listed as Jim Dunn, Jerry Havens, Cecil England, Tom Jones, Bob Ellis, Dave Pelfrey, Gordon McNeil, and Bill Guest. Part of the history, club members cleared forest debris and established good relations with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Soon they'd constructed an 8-slip dock. Today, the private Beaver Lake Sailing Club has lots of amenities, including an air-conditioned and heated clubhouse to accommodate 100 families, from young couples in their 20s to individuals in their 80s. And most everyone pitches in.
2 times a year, we have a work day that everybody participates in, and we keep the docks repaired, and we clean and fix and do projects all over the place to just maintain. We keep our slip fees pretty low because of that, you know, because it's hands-on and people helping people. When somebody, for instance, this boat just raised her mast today, and 4 or 5 people just step in and help, you know, so that's a nice feature of having the club, and people are always there to help each other.
Memberships are very affordable, $25 a month, with slip fees up to $40 per month, so working-class families are able to join.
They have to fill out an application. They pay a $500 initiation fee, actually, now to join the club. And then the board, of which I'm a member, I'm officially called the Rear Commodore. The board approves the membership, and they join. We have a waiting list for slips. and it's full. We are at our capacity of what the Corps will let us build docks.
And sailors, like other recreationalists, are a subculture.
Well, it is a culture. It's a lifestyle. We love it. My husband and I also owned an ocean-going vessel for 8 years, and we cruised Bahamas, Caribbean, West Indies, the coast of Florida. 2 years ago, we sold that and kind of moved back home. But we've been sailing my children grew up on sailboats. I think my daughter came aboard the first time when she was about 10 days old, and I had her in a little wicker basket down below. But yeah, it's just fun.
But this club is also very charitable.
Charity regattas began in about 1992, I believe, and we started racing and having a regatta that people got sponsors for their boats.
Raising money for groups like the Red Cross, local fire department, and now the Arkansas Support Network. Through August 15th, skippers are auctioning off sailboat cruises and other items, with proceeds going to the network, as well as a charity regatta scheduled September 14th. Mike Kieran is Beaver Sailing Club board member at large and vice commodore. He's in charge of the auction.
14 of our club members who have offered their boats up as a opportunity for people to go on a cruise and see what it's like to go sailing and be on a yacht, sort of. We don't really call them yachts because we're not yachters, so much to say. But we do take the sailboats, and we take families or corporate groups or whatever, anybody that wants to go and sail and see what it's like to sail, or take a group of people, families or church groups or whatever. So we are auctioning those off using the Facebook page we set up for that. And then the auction ends August 15th, and when August 15th, then we're going to, whoever has the highest bid, we're going to take those people out and let them experience the sailing life, so to speak.
And really, it's all about sailing for this group, says Judy Walker.
Yes, for sure. And every time that the wind is blowing and you can just raise your sails and gently flow along in the water, it's just an amazing feeling. It really is.
But no sailing for now because Judy's busy helping to organize the Beaver Lake Sailing Club Dock Walk tonight.
This tradition started about 3 years ago, and we originally decided, because we've gotten so big with five docks, Dock 5 is a long way over there, and sometimes you wouldn't really even see each other's boats, and so we have this dock walk where everybody comes down and starts on one end or the other. This year it's Dock 1, and we're providing appetizers and libations. We're actually doing a wine tasting on our dock. We open our boats where people can come aboard and see your cabin and down below. And then we'll spend maybe 30 minutes on Dock 1 and then move dock to dock until... And then, you know, there was a full moon last night, so the plan after we finish the dock walk and into the evening as it cools off, we're going to go out and have a moonlight sail.
And what a weekend to do it, given the full moon was in super perigee, 14% larger as it rose and 30% brighter than normal. 50 people enjoyed a progressive dinner with appetizers on Docks 1 and 2, pasta and Caribbean rum beverages on Dock 4, and your grilled meats on Dock 5. And many spent the night on their boats below deck. A number of marinas operate on Beaver Lake, but the Beaver Lake Sailing Club remains the first and only. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
For a calendar of events or to learn more about the Skipper Cruise Auction for Arkansas Support Network, visit facebook.com/cruisingforkids or beaverlakesailclub.com.
It is Wednesday, July 16th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Karnatz.
Joining us now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Well, it's that time of year where we're announcing seasons.
Yeah.
For all the organizations. And one of the interesting organizations that's based in Bella Vista is called Live on Stage. It's kind of like the old days when there was a series that brought musical acts and other things to your school,
mm-hmm.
except these are bigger time acts.
So they're based in Bella Vista, but I know a lot of their stuff happens at the Aaron Arts Center in Bentonville.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's a national organization. So there's Live on Stage in Northwest Arkansas,
sure.
and there's Live on Stage everywhere. So they have just announced their season.
Okay.
Season tickets are $85. Single show tickets are $25. So this is a real bargain to buy into the season. September 21st is Simply Sinatra. November 9th is Fernando Varela, who, according to my notes, sings opera and pop and is the very picture of the modern tenor.
Hmm.
Okay. March 1st of next year is Live from Nashville. April 9th is William Florian. He will do a show called Those Were the Days. He's an iconic music songwriter and performer. And did a lot of songs for John Denver.
Oh, very cool.
Okay. And May 3rd is Paul McDermott. So if you want to find out more about these artists, you can visit liveonstagenwa.com. Of course, we'll write about them and what's up as they come along. Or call 855-9997 for season tickets.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Just in time for Midsummer, a new release of A Midsummer Night's Dream incidental music from Mendelssohn by the Gewandhaus Orchestra led by Ricardo Chailly. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of Of Note Monday through Friday from 11 to noon on KYF, as well as 6 p.m. weeknights on KYF 2. Join me for Mendelssohn's A Midsummer Night's Dream incidental music on Thursday's program. This is Ozarks at Large. Of Arkansas's 75 counties, 37 are dry, meaning they don't allow the sale of alcohol. Efforts are underway to get the wet-dry issue on the November ballot in some of these places, including Craighead, Faulkner, and Saline counties. A new report from the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Arkansas analyzed the economic impact of legalizing retail alcohol sales in these three counties. Kathy Deck, director of the center, says the report was produced for Our Community, Our Dollars, a group working to give residents in these three counties the chance to vote on the wet or dry issue in the fall. Deck recently stopped by Studio 123 to tell me more about this report. Now, oftentimes with data, when you're looking at data, you look at data that already exists and you tell me what that means. You look for trends. Here, it's kind of a hypothetical because they aren't wet yet or haven't been wet. And so how do you approach that sort of looking for what impact this would have, not knowing what impact it would have?
Well, we had a bit of an assumption, and all economists make assumptions about all kinds of things. But one of the assumptions we made is that the people in these counties are pretty much like the people, average Arkansans everywhere. And we know that on average, Arkansans spend $191 a year on liquor and wine sales. They spend another $150 a year on beer sales. And so if we assume that the folks in these counties are, in fact, acting like demographically similar people throughout Arkansas, we can assume that they're actually already spending money on retail liquor, and this just gives them an opportunity to spend that money closer to home.
So what were some of the numbers that you looked at? I assume you dug into some things from the census, because the census always has so much information.
So we looked at overall liquor sales in Arkansas. We looked at overall beer and wine sales in Arkansas. We looked at population demographics and income and all kinds of things that allow us to know what people look like. And then we used an economic impact model to understand what it means when you make sales in a particular place. It doesn't just have an impact on that particular sale, but it makes its way through the community as that dollar gets turned over and over.
And when trying to measure this, how did you decide what areas to look at to prove an economic, you know, impact?
So we looked where we can find data. So we can find data at the county level. We can find data at the city level. And when we talk about tax revenues, those are going to happen at the county and the city level. And so we also used regulations as we know them. We know that there can't be but a certain number of packaged liquor sales per county, per city. It depends on every 5,000 people, you need at least that many in your community to have a store, for example. And so we used all of the things that we know to make what we consider very, very reasonable assumptions about the kinds of sales that are actually already happening. They're just not happening within these counties right now.
Okay, so the assumption with this would be that if these counties were wet, that money would just move back to this county as opposed to the neighboring county where this person is probably already spending this money.
That's correct. So we didn't have to make any heroic assumptions about that suddenly people would start buying all kinds of alcohol and substituting away from other sales. We tried to get a sense of how much they would already be spending if they look like typical Arkansans.
Okay. And how do you look at the economic impact? Did you narrow it to, you know, jobs that would be created by these stores, or?
Sure. So we used a traditional economic impact model, the M-Plan model. And so what happens is when you make a retail sale, you only get the retail margin on that. So we know that, for example, the liquor is not being produced in these counties. The liquor is, there are all kinds of parts of the production process that, and the economic process that aren't happening in these counties. So you just look at the economic impact of that retail margin. And then, of course, these retailers are going to go out and they're going to hire people. Those people are going to go out and spend money in their communities. But that bit gets less and less and less as it goes on. And so when you put all of those impacts together, you're able to calculate a multiplier effect and understand what the economic impact is going to be on a community.
So what did you find in this report?
So we found that it depended upon the county. Obviously, these three counties have different economies somewhat. But the overall economic impacts were likely on an annual basis to be somewhere between around $10,500,000 and around $12,500,000, depending on which county you were looking at. And it was going to create, again, on a yearly basis, around 150 jobs in each of these communities, 140 to 150, depending on which one you looked at.
Was there anything that you found that was surprising to you?
This is pretty straightforward stuff, actually, from an economics perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that, again, liquor sales are happening already. We know that beer and wine is being sold across the state. It's a much bigger market than folks realize sometimes. And so this is really just a redistribution of the geography of where these sales are going to take place.
You mentioned it being straightforward. To me, from my layperson standpoint, it does seem pretty straightforward in the sense that, you know, you don't have liquor stores, but if you have liquor stores, it's a reasonable assumption that somebody's going to use them. And so it's going to produce more money than there is right now because there aren't any.
That's right. And so there are other impacts that we would like to talk about, something like that liquor stores are part of economies that have other attributes. They may, in fact, be part of the modern economy. It might be something that folks who the creative class or whatever you want to talk about look for in a community if they want to live and work there. Those kind of impacts are very, very difficult to put a number on. And so we you know, acknowledge that those kinds of things exist, costs and benefits of that nature. But we really tried to stick more in line with estimating those sales that are a little bit harder.
Absolutely. It's something that someone might use at some other point to say, you know, well, if you have these things, you know, you might be more likely to have more nighttime venues, which could draw more people and things like that. But that's just outside of the scope of what you did.
That's really outside the scope of what we were able to calculate. And I don't think that it's really that practical to put that kind of a number on the economic impact.
Absolutely. So what does this report mean going forward? How can this serve people better? Or how can this be useful to someone?
I think that this impact is just another piece of information. So I think it's important to understand that these economic activities do happen. They're just not happening in these particular places, in these counties, in these cities. And this just gives a magnitude for what those sales might look like and what the counties and the cities could reasonably expect to see if these initiatives pass.
And like we said, there's a lot of assumptions happening here. So when you have something like this where you know, your report says that, you know, millions of dollars could be made that are not being made right now, do you sometimes have to caution people that you're saying there's no guarantee that this is what will happen? These are just...
I should take you around with me. There's always a caveat that there's no guarantee. Again, I think this provides a very reasonable and conservative estimate as to what the numbers might look like.
Right. And I wondered if you just had to people get so excited seeing numbers sometimes that when you're looking at this, that I wondered if you as a researcher have to caution people. Now, this is just an assumption. This is a projection. Right. Well, this is no guarantee.
We used all kinds of assumptions. As I mentioned, mm-hmm. we looked back at 2013. Obviously, 2014 is not exactly like 2013.
Sure.
But we use the best available data to make, as I say, good estimates using good standard economic principles, and we feel pretty comfortable with them.
Has the center ever done something similar to this before?
We have. We looked when Benton County was looking at going wet. We did a similar type study. We basically try to understand what the sales are going to look like. We also talk a little bit about construction impacts. There could obviously be some new facilities, but those are kind of one-time impacts. You build the building and then it gets added to the property tax rolls.
Sure.
And such.
Now, with Benton County, you did the projections of what that would be, and it has gone. What have you guys done any research to go back and see how your numbers compared?
We haven't followed up exactly yet to see if the numbers were correct. But as you
I just
can
didn't know if that was something that you did. Or
we like to go back and make sure that we're not making assumptions that are entirely wrong. But we haven't seen the full impacts yet of Benton County being wet. It hasn't actually been all that long, so we'll have a chance to get all of those data and look back pretty soon now.
Okay, is that something to look forward to there? And when comparing those, how can that be helpful to you moving forward?
Well, obviously, as we do these studies in the future, the better our information is, and the better our assumptions are, the better the end product is going to be, and the better the information for the broad public is. And that's what our mission is to give the public good information. So it obviously is worth examining those assumptions all the time.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Kathy Deck, the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Arkansas. She recently stopped by the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss a new report that analyzes the economic impact of legalizing retail alcohol sales in Craighead, Faulkner, and Saline counties. The full report is available online at cber.uark.edu.
As August in Arkansas nears and temperatures continue to creep up, many might be spending as much time as possible in the air-conditioned indoors. But what about spending time in the naturally cooled outdoors? It does exist. In this month's installment of our Spaces series, we go inside, outside, with a visit to War Eagle Cavern, east of Rogers. When Dennis Boyer and his wife bought this property in the early 1990s, many of their family and friends thought they were crazy to move from Florida to these 22 overgrown acres in the Ozark Hills.
When we first bought it, there was no paved road even coming down here, no paved parking lots. You couldn't even see through the woods here what was here. So we feel we've kind of come a long way on it.
Today, it's a genuine park-like setting and a tourist destination, seeing up to 30,000 visitors each year. Billboards and brochures guide tourists from every direction to this spot off Highway 12. The cavern itself is one of 200 show caves in the United States, among the 80% that are privately owned. The cave first opened to the public in the 1970s, and those owners gave it its name after the Indian chief War Eagle, who lived in the area in the 1830s. Prior to that, when it was open to the public in a different sense, it was called Bat Cave by the locals. Tours of the cave leave every 30 minutes, made up of about 15 people, to keep the experience close and personal. Getting to the cave is a windy downhill path in the Ozarks, and you'll have to get back up that same Ozark Hill. As you make it down and wind a curve in the path, you'll see a small finger of Beaver Lake, known as Devil's Gap. Dennis and his wife live on the property and have a lovely view of this finger from their large back deck. It's important to note, for the cave, that Beaver Lake is a man-made lake that was formed in the 1960s by damming the White River.
Before the lake was here, there's a stream that comes out of this cave that fed down into a valley at one time and joined with the White River. That's how the first people, probably Indians or outlaws or moonshiners or early pioneers or soldiers, actually found the cave. We have no idea who discovered this cave. It was simply used as people come up a valley following a stream, looking for a source of fresh water, got to the end and simply walked into our cave.
We too follow the stream for a portion of the 5-minute walk to the mouth of the cave. The cool temperatures can be felt a good 10 feet before we enter. At one time, families would camp here at the entrance for weeks at a time, with the temperature dropping to about 58 degrees once inside the cave. A wide opening quickly narrows into a tunnel leading into the 4 miles of explored passageways of the cave.
Indians, the first to use this cave, though, were very superstitious people, and they only made it in about this far into the cave. If they couldn't turn around, still see some daylight, they wouldn't go any further. But later on, as people moved into the area, they started exploring. When it was open for tours, they enhanced a passageway here that we're going to walk through today on there. So let's walk on in a little bit further on here.
We make our way through an area he refers to as Wind Tunnel and run into a tour in progress that left the top shortly before we did.
I mean, let me ask y'all, how many of you, if you ran across this natural entrance, would be tempted to crawl in here and see what you could find? Yeah, a bunch of you, right? I mean, if you were lucky.
Curtis is one of the guides the Boyers employ. Some are full-time and avid cavers. Curtis is a professor at NWAC during the school year, but has enjoyed giving tours during his summer vacation for 9 years now. The group he leads varies in age from the very young to the much older. Dennis and I bypass the tour, and he tells me about initials they found a good 2 miles back into the cave. They date back to the 1830s. The carvers would have gone back there with nothing more than a candle. We walk up to a carving that reads Moore Stanford, 1928. Scratched underneath reads Back, 1965. So old Moore Stanford came back some 30-plus years later. As we walk into the main room, lit by several small candle-shaped orange lights, there are many corners and cubbies to explore. As we walk, there is some moonshine equipment to our left. Though it is just for show now, the still was actually found inside the cavern.
And we know from other people coming in telling us that, oh yeah, our relatives made moonshine in old War Eagle Cave, or Bat Cave, as it was called then. So it was a natural place to hide from the law and have a nice, comfortable, air-conditioned place to make your moonshine on here.
20 years ago, the film Frank and Jesse, starring Rob Lowe, Randy Travis, and Bill Paxton, was filmed inside the cave and on the 22 acres surrounding it. They spent just over a week filming here.
The real Frank and Jesse James are known to have used the cave back in the 1870s. Their grandfather on the Samuelson side had a farm just up the road from here. And so the Jameses would actually come and visit, hide their horses and gear in the front of this cave, get fresh water, and go visit other relatives. So the cave has been used by outlaws, moonshiners, and during the Civil War, the Battle of Pea Ridge occurred just on the other side of the lake.
Thousands of soldiers, both going to and retreating from the battle, came right through here. There have been several rumors of outlaws stashing gold and silver here, including Pretty Boy Floyd, a gangster in the 1930s, who is said to have had a girlfriend who lived in Rogers, and he'd hide loot in the cave when he was visiting her. History aside, though it's a big part of every War Eagle Cavern tour, there are many scientific discoveries to be made. Several holes about the size of a large manhole exist in the large cave ceiling. The cavern was formed by an underground river carving into the side of the mountain, which led to these domes.
Well, sometimes at a full volume of water, the water couldn't get out the front that it already opened. So water pressure will simply dig straight up. We have these holes that go up in the ceiling, some 50 and 60 feet or more. It was caused by water pressure digging its way up. This particular one even opens into a passage up in the second floor area. So we have quite a honeycomb passage of second floor above us on here. We're going to head on down here a little bit.
There's water everywhere in this live, wet, and actively growing cave. Water drips from above, and Dennis says if one hits you, they call it a good luck drop. It's very pure, having filtered through several feet of limestone before it drips down into the cave. The stream we follow in here has an unknown source. Explorers, including Dennis, have traced it underground for nearly 4 miles, but have yet to find where it starts. And it's slippery inside the cave. There are wood pathways that have been laid over the slick rock and handrails installed in the steep places.
Now watch your step. We're going down a little bit of the bridge here. But after heavy rains, this water can roar through here well over the top of our trail sometimes. This is called Headache Rock for a good reason. If you don't duck your head, you will know why. So test the ceiling with your hand as you come underneath on here.
We duck our heads under yet another low ceiling and into another room. It seems to keep going and going. This room has a loud waterfall moving over a shelf about head high and into the flowing stream. Lights have been installed along the shelf so visitors can see the beauty they are hearing.
And you may notice on here that there are little ponds of water. These here are what's called rimstone dams. They're step or ladder dams. As the water cascades over an edge, it actually builds a wall a little taller, making a little dam, creating a small little pond behind it. These ponds can vary anywhere from 2 inches to up to 5 inches deep on there.
The next passageway we walk through didn't exist in its current state until about 2 years ago. Prior to that, it was just 2 feet tall. And to continue on, guests had to be part of a special wild tour. Tubular striations can be seen on what is now about a 6-foot tall ceiling, from holes drilled by specialists to insert dynamite into to bring the rock down. It would take about 2 days to haul out the rock freed from each blast. The entire process took about 4 months, and in total, they removed 300 tons of rock. Wild tours now start at the back of this lake room, where a pool of water about 3 feet deep hangs out in the cavernous room. Wild tours are held from July through October. They are not conducted in the spring because the bats that live here are in maternity colonies, and they don't want to disturb the babies. Those babies are now grown and flying about. A slightly foul stench can be smelled throughout the cave. With over 100,000 bats living here, they tend to poop in a few places, though the larger colonies live deeper in the cave. Dennis speaks of the bats kindly, referring to them as our bats. Other guides had reported seeing flying activity on the day of my visit, but I didn't see a single bat. I did, however, spot an orange cave salamander sitting atop a pile of their guano, in search of the flies and insects that he could find there. Deeper in the cave, the salamanders have no eyes or color. Guests to the cave will also learn about the columns, stalagmites, and stalactites they see along the way. But since this cave was formed by an underground river, there aren't as many here as there are in some of the other caves in our area. School children will often take full-day field trips here to learn the ins and outs of the cavern and explore the park's grounds. The maintenance and insurance of running a cave is much like any other business or attraction. Dennis is a member of the National Cave Association and a member of the Arkansas and Missouri Cave Association, but considers himself more of a hobbyist than an expert.
Always enjoyed caves, and it's just kind of, it becomes a learning experience in anything. You start reading the history of the area, geology of such. So I suppose more of this self-taught from probably a lifetime of enjoying caves.
War Eagle Cavern and its grounds are open 7 days a week for tours through November. For more information, visit wareaglecavern.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
Here, now, in the moment.
It's a fast-moving stream of news and information. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are your co-hosts for Here and Now, Public Radio's midday news program, bringing you news that breaks between Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
With voices from across the country and around the world, news and conversation you won't want to miss.
That's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Whitener.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Karnatz.
Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back along with her co-host, Kyle Kellums.
Yes, I will.
And remember, you can listen to us anytime at ozarksatlarge.com, or you can download our podcast. We'll end today's show with a song called Raise Some Hell by the Dirty River Boys. They'll be playing at George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville Thursday night. That's tomorrow. You can find out more at dirtyriverboys.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a great Wednesday.
Your worries gone, so pour you one and drink it down. Sing until the early morn.